It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Charlie Rich, Howlin' Wolf. The list goes on and on. These are all artists that recorded at Sun Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, effectively discovered and brought to the world by record producer Sam Phillips. Sam Phillips has been called the man who invented rock and roll, and that is the subtitle of the book by renowned music journalist Peter Guralnick. After a decade of diligence, he scored an interview with Sam Phillips that opened up a treasure trove of anecdotes and insight into how rock and roll was made at the earliest formative stages. He brings them all to the world in Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll, now out in paperback. And we welcome Peter Guralnick to the program. Peter, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You worked on this project for a long time, and of course there's an overlap with your other books on Elvis Presley and other writing, but you had to pursue an interview with Sam Phillips for a number of years.
Well, that's true. I mean, I guess I should stress that I've never worked on anything that didn't take a long time. And in some ways, I mean, that's emblematic of the commitment that you want to make to something that you really care about, because, you know, nothing happens overnight. But with Sam, I at first heard from his son, Knox, his older son, Knox, in response, I think, to the publication of Feel Like Going Home. I mean, this is a terrible confession for somebody who, you know, does all this research for his books, but one of the very few things I've never been able to find is that first letter that Knox wrote to me, which probably came in 71 or 72. There was stuff in Feel Like Going Home. There was an interlude that was all about Sun Records, and I think I may have even said, if I ever have the chance, I'd like to write a book about Sam Phillips or Sun Records. But from that point on, I became friends with Knox. I went down to Memphis. We became the best of friends. And for years, both of our aims was to set up an interview with Sam, with his father. But Sam just wasn't doing any interviews. He simply simply refused to do them. He thought it was really a matter of looking back, and he was committed always to looking forward. And so Knox kept saying, I know it's going to happen. And while I was researching the book on Sam, you know, the man who invented rock and roll, I came across, through Knox's and the whole family's good offices, I just had access to all the papers. I came across a long and passionate letter that Knox had written to Sam saying why I would be worth talking to. But Sam did not act on that letter, not for a long time.
The thing about Sam Phillips is that even though he may not have given interviews for a long time, and once you started talking to him, the floodgates kind of opened, but he certainly liked to talk to people, and he was quite the storyteller. Was it hard during the course of interviewing him and talking with him and gathering the information for this book and others, was it hard to parse out the embellishments? Were there any stories that were so irresistible that you wanted to put them in some form, even though you knew they might just have been stories?
No, I mean, Sam didn't tell stories in that sense. The embellishments were actually more verbal. They were embellishments of vocabulary. They were embellishments of, you might say, of a certain sense of grandiosity. But unlike Solomon Burke, who, again, was one of the most brilliant and creative people I've ever met. I mean, I always say that if I were to name one person who was the most charismatic person I ever met, my kids say, name Sam. I mean, at least when the book is out, and I always say Sam and Solomon, and they really both were. But Solomon made up stories which were fables, essentially. They were always based on something that happened, but they embellished in a way that was truly wonderful, that showed his great imaginative resourcefulness, but that took leave at some point of the diurnal details. Sam's stories didn't change, and they were based very literally on what happened. The value that he might ascribe to them, or the particular impact that he might ascribe to them, you could agree or disagree with. But I think the point is that when I was a kid, my grandfather always used to say to me, keep your eye on the ball, which had to do with both baseball and life, and it's much more significant in life. It's hard sometimes to do that. And I've felt with all the people that I've met, if I were talking about Solomon Burke, he was dedicated to the con. I mean, it was just something that he couldn't avoid. But at his heart, he was one of the funniest, most soulful, most intellectual, most brilliant, most humorous. I mean, just, you know, all of those things. And so I wasn't particularly interested in the surface. I mean, I could enjoy the surface to a degree. And it's the same as if you meet somebody who is addicted to something. It doesn't matter what they're addicted to, but I mean, whether it's drugs or it's alcohol or it's something else. that's on the surface. Who is the person underneath? And that's what I've looked for all along. I mean, when I met somebody like Jack Clement, who was one of Sam's most dedicated students, the first person who ever went to work for Sam as what would be called a producer today, and almost the only one. But when I met Jack Clement, Jack established this elaborate mythology around himself. He was Cowboy Jack Clement because he hated horses. But he is, again, a truly brilliant person. But I was interested in the person underneath who was, you know, it's not that the front was a clown. He wasn't simply entertaining, but there was a profound part underneath. There was a tragic part underneath, or at least there was a melancholy part underneath, and that was what interested me. And I guess that's what's interested me in everybody I've ever written about, is the creative core.
Well, it seems interesting as you describe Sam Phillips having a consistency in talking about the facts of his work, and that would seem to be similar to what he wanted to do with his work, which was to bring authenticity to record, essentially. So when Sam Phillips opened what would become Sun Studios, who did he expect to be his clients?
He opened the studio totally. This is a storefront studio, just the tiniest place, the kind of place that when Ike Turner drove up to make a record, he drove past it three or four times because he thought it was a barbershop. But when Sam opened up that studio on January 2nd, 1950, the entire purpose was, this is in his words, to record some of the great Negro artists of the South who had nowhere else to go. And that was his purpose, was basically, it was similar, I guess, to Alan Lomax as an ethnomusicologist or a folklorist. It was to record music that he found so profound, so inspiring, so beyond anything that mainstream America, and you might read white America for that, had ever experienced, and something so spiritual in his sense, and I don't mean religious, but just spiritual, something that reached the spirit, that was what he wanted to record. And he wanted to record it, as you said, he wanted it to be everything that he set out to do. He wanted it to be real, and he would say, R-E-A-L, real, you know, and then he would hit his hand on a flat surface. But he also, and I mean, this is really his aesthetic, or part of his aesthetic, was like Hemingway, he wanted to create a language that made the real more real. I mean, it was an artificial language to give authenticity to what was real, but at the same time to create a greater kind of reality, so that with Hemingway, particularly when his books were first published, his early, his collections of short stories, The Sun Also Rises, critics, I think, would say he writes dialogue exactly the way people speak. But the fact is he didn't. It reflected exactly the way that people spoke, but he found a manner of presenting it that gave it a greater authenticity than it would have had he simply put down what you and I are saying right now. I mean, he whether it was a rhythm or it was pauses, and Sam did the same thing in many ways from the very first time that he opened the studio.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick. His book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, is about the founder of Sun Studios, who recorded first the pantheon of early rock and roll, including most famously Elvis Presley. So, Peter, let's talk a little bit about his desire to make things sound real and authentic, which, as you say, he had to employ certain techniques to do that. And this might be a little bit technical, but it's really interesting to me because there are mistakes on those records. And some people might think that those mistakes are just like, well, you know, tape cost money at the time. It wasn't a digital age. We could just do everything 1,000 times. And studio time was in some ways precious. So those mistakes were okay with him in reaching his overall goal. But also he had to do other things to make the music have the kind of power that it might have if you were standing in the same room. What are some of the things that Sam Phillips did technically to make those rock and roll records sound, and blues records sound, real and energetic?
Well, I mean, one thing was, and I should say, you could listen, I could listen, your listeners could listen, that in many cases, songs that came out, a record like Blue Suede Shoes, say, by Carl Perkins, and you may find mistakes in it. You could also find a take that was done after the released version was recorded, which is perfect, but for Sam, didn't have the feel, and for him, the mistakes were what gave the record its authenticity. The mistakes were the things that you can never avoid in life. And when somebody like Carl Perkins objected when he was in the recording session itself, and when he would say to Sam, "But Mr. Phillips, there's a mistake in there," and they would go back and forth on this, and Sam would let him record it over again. It wasn't that it wasn't. You're right. The tape cost money, but even so, Sam would indulge him and listen to it. But he said, "The thing is, that's the one that's got the feeling. People are not going to hear the mistake. They're going to hear the feeling." And Carl Perkins would come back and say, "But Mr. Phillips, it's still a mistake." And he says, "Well, that's what we are here at Sun Records. We're just one big inspired mistake." And he believed in this thing called perfect imperfection, which, you know, goes by many names in many different fields. I mean, it's not a new aesthetic. But the idea was that perfection was boring and perfection was inhuman, and that perfection, you know, took away from the vitality and the authenticity of what you were hearing. And not that he wanted to have the mistake overshadow the entire effect, but the mistake was what gave it its vitality, its verve. And when it had a telephone go off in the middle of a session with Jimmy DeBerry, a song called "Time Has Brought About a Change," Sam kept the telephone on the release record. You can hear it to this day. And he said, "You think I was going to release a song without that telephone on it? You know, I couldn't have paid to get a better sound than that telephone." You know, you can argue with that. You can say that's ridiculous. But that's how committed he was to the idea that it's life's chances. It's life's unpredictable things. It's the things we can't altogether either focus on or count on or predict. It's the rough edges that give both our experience and the music its impact. But in terms of what one of the things that he did, right around the time that Elvis Presley first came into the studio in 1954, he hit on a thing called slapback, which is basically repetitive echo. This was something that was in the air at the time that people like Les Paul and Universal Studios, Bill Putnam and Les Paul really pioneered in the use of echo on records. Les Paul used pioneered in overdubs, too. But this sense of using echo to enhance the sound, to make it sound more natural, to make it sound the way people heard music when they went out to bars or juke joints or clubs or whatever. And these were usually done in echo chambers, which were in a big studio, were created as a separate space, or you could use a hallway as you could put an amplifier out in the hallway and then create the echo out there. But Sam didn't have that big a studio, and what he did was he set up two tape recorders, two Ampex 350s, and he fed the initial sound that came off of the recording tape recorder into what he called a slapback recorder or an echo tape recorder. So that sound would go from its initial recording into the second Ampex 350, then get fed back into the board, and he could control the time that it took to go back to the board. But it both amplified the sound that you had. It could create a sound of genuine, almost up in the Swiss mountains echo, you know, if you delayed it long enough. But that wasn't what he tended to do. It was used often, generally, much more subtly, but it's as if the vocal or the guitar were double-tracked. And when he started out, he could only use one source to use the slapback on, and generally it was the vocal, and it might be, it depended on how close the instrument was. It might include the instrument or not include the instrument. Later on, he had multiple sources. But fundamentally, the idea was people would be hearing the music not in the perfection of a recording studio, but in much the same manner as they would be hearing it if they went out to hear live music, which is what he felt was not only reassuring, but also was more real. But prior to that, in recording the blues, long before he had discovered this slapback technique, in 54, in recording Howlin' Wolf and recording B.B. King and recording Ike Turner and all the blues singers, basically he recorded everything as hot as he possibly could, right up to the edge of distortion and sometimes past the point of distortion. If you listen to the guitarists on so many of the blues records, I mean, they're really right up against the level. And yet, as an engineer, somebody who trained as an engineer and prided himself on his ears and prided himself as an engineer, he never went so far that the sound broke down. But it was something that created an excitement, that created, again, a sense of rawness and vitality and reality that was what he was looking for.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick. His book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, is about the founder of Sun Studios. Of course, people know a lot of the Elvis catalog. They know Johnny Cash. They know maybe even Howlin' Wolf. But there were a number of artists that Sam Phillips recorded that might not be as well known, but they were nonetheless very influential. And some of these are very interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the prison heirs?
Well, the prison heirs were prisoners in the Tennessee State Prison in Nashville. And they came to Sam's attention through a very brief partnership with a guy named Jim Bullitt, who had been a force in the Nashville recording industry, had had a number of big hits on his own Bullitt label, but had sort of fallen on hard times when Sam got together with him in 53, really. And he didn't last till the end of 54. But he had contact with a song publisher, a music publisher in Nashville, who brought the prison heirs, who were a quintet, all of them incarcerated in the Tennessee State Penitentiary in Nashville, and who had started going around and playing at different churches and on the radio to some extent because of the policies, the enlightened policies of Frank Clement, who was then the governor, Democratic governor, and Sam would say the greatest governor the state of Tennessee ever had, because Sam was a lifelong Democrat, both big D and little d. He would be very upset by political developments today. So the whole idea was rehabilitation. This was Clement's. Clement was committed to it. And when Sam heard the group, who were basically a group that was modeled on the Ink Spots and on the lead singing of Bill Kenny, who was a huge influence on Elvis Presley, as well as a huge influence on gospel groups like the Soul Stirrers, for example, an enormously influential figure, Bill Kenny, and the Ink Spots had had big, big pop hits. And that's who the prison heirs were modeled on. And when Sam heard them, he was knocked out, but he was also knocked out by the concept behind it. You know, he just said, can you imagine the devastation I felt? I think devastation was the word he used. When I heard this group and they fit in so perfectly with my whole idea about humanity and about the idea of prison rehabilitation and the idea that everybody should deserve a chance and the idea that people were not treated fairly or equitably in the society, particularly black people. So he arranged to have the prison heirs transported to a studio. The initial idea was that he would come over to Nashville and record them in the prison, you know, almost the way a field researcher would do, the way somebody like Alan Lomax, for example, would do, an ethnomusicologist. But he wanted to record them under the most perfect conditions, under the conditions that he could control and that could represent their sound in the best way that he considered possible. And they spent a long, long afternoon in the Sun studio in the summer of 53, early in the summer of 53. And there was a very good demo version of the song, Just Singing in the Rain, that was sort of their keynote song. Just Walking in the Rain, not Singing in the Rain. There was a reporter from the Commercial Appeal of the Press Scimitar, who observed this and talked about how the exacting Mr. Phillips had them recorded over and over again until he got just the sound that he wanted. And it isn't that different from the demo, and there's an alternate take, which, again, is not that different. And yet you can tell by the version that he finally got that it was exactly the version he was looking for in terms of both its spontaneity and just its synthesis of the sound that they were aiming for. And Just Walking in the Rain was a big hit by the standards of the day. What didn't turn out to be as big a hit as it sort of jumped right out of out of the box and sold probably 30,000 copies, and then I think the returns started coming in. It may not have sold much more than 30,000 or 40,000 copies. It was recorded a few years later by Johnny Ray, pop singer, and it was a huge hit for him. But Sam didn't own the publishing, so that didn't have an impact on his business. But it was tremendously influential and just was a key element to his whole concept of what Sun Records, by now, he had started Sun Records initially in 52, but really in 53, and what Sun Records by now he felt should come to represent. So it was an anomaly in a sense, because he recorded very few groups, but it represented exactly the kind of thing that he wanted to do.
And having that kind of high-profile recording played on the radio stations in the area helped bring in business, I would assume. Because it seems as if this is maybe a different kind of example with the prison heirs, because he sought them out. But all of these legends of music just showed up at his door, sometimes unannounced, and had to kind of pitch themselves. And, of course, most famously, Elvis Presley was one of them.
Well, that's true. I mean, Elvis Presley came in, I'm quite certain, because of the article that was in the Memphis newspaper about the prison heirs and spoke of this young man, this young studio owner, Mr. Phillips, who was open to different sounds, to sounds of every sort, to sounds, you know, that were not like the sounds that were on the radio, to originality and spontaneity. And Elvis came in within a month or two, not for a professional tryout. He came in to make a personal record, which was a record you pay for. You can make personal records to this day. And you paid $4 for two sides. And I'm sure it was in Elvis's mind that he would be, this is a 19-year-old kid, just graduated from high school, but I'm sure it was in this young Elvis Presley's mind, just like it's in the mind of every kid who's playing baseball or soccer or whatever, that, you know, that a scout is going to see him and discover him and he's on his way to the major leagues. And I'm sure it was in Elvis's mind that he would be discovered by this young Mr. Phillips, which didn't turn out to be the case at all. I mean, he recorded his song, he went home with it. You can hear it today at the two sides of it, one of which was an Ink Spots number, and it's remarkable. I mean, it sounds like Elvis Presley, but it didn't cause his immediate discovery, and he came back in January, recorded another personal record. That didn't cause his immediate discovery, and he was called in by Sam at his assistant Marion Keisker's suggestion to record a song that Sam had gotten from Nashville that he felt needed a singer. That didn't work out, and then he put him together with Scotty Moore, who had made one record for Sun at that point with the Starlight Wranglers, a group that he was playing with, and had become very close to Sam. And Scotty called himself a Sun Records scout. I mean, I don't know if that existed formally, but he was close to Sam, and Sam put Elvis together with Scotty and brought them into the studio for it wasn't even an audition session, it was a rehearsal session, and that's what Elvis's first record came out of.
And the rest was history.
More or less, yeah. But, you know, one thing you mentioned about people mm-hmm. coming in almost because of, just on the basis that they've heard about the studio from someone else.
Word of mouth.
Long before Elvis came into the studio, you had Ike Turner coming in because B.B. King knew Ike Turner down in Mississippi where Ike Turner lived. Ike Turner was just an 18 or 19-year-old kid. And B.B. King said, you ought to make records, and, you know, gave him the name of Sam Phillips and spoke to Sam Phillips about him. This is in 1951, and that's how Ike Turner came up to the studio. And when Sam opened the studio, he had no way of getting this African-American talent that he was looking to record into the studio other than by word of mouth. And ultimately what happened, again, this is very early in 1950, a one-man band named Joe Hill Lewis wandered into the studio while he was still building it and said, what do you do? I mean, this is a very gregarious one-man band, a very talented blues singer, but also a very gregarious and, I think, charming person. And he asked Sam what he was doing, and Sam said, I'm building a studio. And Joe Hill Lewis said, that's just what we need here in Memphis, a recording studio. And subsequent to that, most of the initial artists who came in just off the street to Sam were people that came in at the recommendation of Joe Hill Lewis, who really didn't know anything about it other than he thought that this is what Memphis needed.
And Sam Phillips felt that Memphis needed it too, and he was coming out of a different industry. He wasn't a recording engineer by trade, per se. And it's fascinating is how much radio influenced what he ended up doing. For most of his career, really, he was more of a radio guy than he was a studio guy, or a promoter, or a record company guy.
If it weren't for him coming out of that industry, was so close that you could have...
It was all about communication from Sam's point of view and reaching people and letting the music or the radio or the sounds just take you away. It was about imagination.
Yeah, and the fact that at that point, in that place, which was like, talk about the right place at the right time with the right people, you know, mm-hmm. Memphis and the music, that the people that lived there that were not too far away from recording and not too far away from the radio, and that the stations and what they played might have been segregated, but you could just turn the dial and you could listen to anything you wanted. I mean
radio predated rock and roll as one of the great integrators, you know, in the society, because there was no telling what somebody was listening to behind closed doors. And, you know, people might say, well, you know, what was the greatest thing that ever happened to Elvis Presley? Well, it was moving to Memphis. And it was moving to Memphis for what was, for the fact that Memphis was a metropolis, and it was, but also that all of these sounds that simply were not going to be available to him in Tupelo were available to him on the radio primarily. I mean, you know, he could buy records, but he couldn't afford a lot of records. And he could walk down the street and he could hear sounds, and he heard those sounds. But it was radio, you know, the fact that you had WDIA, the first all-Negro station in the nation, you know. And you had WHBQ, where Dewey Phillips was on every night doing his Red Hot and Blue show with both black and white music with Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and just the great Muddy Waters, and the, it could be the Blackwood Brothers, too, and Frank Sinatra, but the greatest music in the world, and with an equal parts black and white audience. I mean, where else would you find something like that?
Peter Guralnick's book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, is out in paperback. Also, there's an enhanced version, and it details far more than we have the amazing career of Sam Phillips, who brought so many fantastic artists, ranging from Elvis Presley to Johnny Cash to Howlin' Wolf and others, to Record for the First Time. Peter, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, well, listen, thank you. I've enjoyed it.